Our next speaker is Dr. Jose Diaz from the University of Maryland. He's going to speak to us about pneumatosis intestinalis. My subtitle would be A Disease of CT Scans.
Well, thank you very much, guys, for inviting me for this great opportunity. I find that I learned just as much as I do preparing for these as I do sitting in the audience listening to these. I have no conflicts or disclosures related to pneumatosis intestinalis. Don't get it. So I'm just going to start off with a case, which is a typical scenario that most of us actually end up seeing these patients. And many of the history of this particular patient is typical of the kind of patients that we're usually likely to see. So this unfortunate lady is an 82-year-old female with a history of coronary artery disease, congestive heart failure, aortic stenosis, COPD, hyperlipidemia, peripheral vascular disease, who is now about a day post-op after a floor of mouth resection. She has a trach, and she's had an all-day reconstruction by your favorite head and neck surgeons. And now she's decompensated in your ICU, and she's on Levofed. The exam appears to be that she has a full, tense, distended abdomen. She's tympanitic to percussion, and she winces on palpation. The laboratory has come back. She has an elevated white count of 29. Her first lactate was 12, and after some resuscitation, it has come down to 4.6. So the proverbial CT scan has been obtained before you've even been called. And now you've been called to the typical come save the patient consult. You get the proverbial CT scan, and it looks like this. We'll just walk you through some of these. Clearly, if you've not used to seeing this, you know, air rises, so when it doesn't rise, it's a typical consistent with evidence of pneumatosis. I like to see these coronal films here because it gives you a nice view of, you know, the various obvious perspective. And if you're not seeing, if you're not used to seeing air in the portal vein, that's what it looks like right there. This is an ominous sign. But is it always an ominous sign? So there's a couple of large prospective and some retrospective studies that looked at pneumatosis intestinalis, and both of these were in our acute care surgery journal. The first was a PIPE study that looked at 500 patients in a retrospective manner. 60% of these patients had benign disease. So in other words, they did not progress to an operation, although 40% of these patients actually did have pathologic disease, did progress to an operation or resection. So a little less than 50-50. Subsequently, there was an actual prospective trial presented and demonstrated that patients with a lactate greater than 2 really was kind of the cutoff, and clearly, obviously, a patient presenting with peritonitis. And for the younger surgeons in the audience, the KUB on the right side of the film is what we used to obtain, and you can clearly see the pneumatosis on the plain film there. So what about CT scan? Every morning when I do my morning report with my team, we look through CT scans of the night before and, you know, the various typical patients that we see, and then we run through a list of what are you supposed to look for. So what are you supposed to look for in a CT scan? You're supposed to look for mural thickening, evidence of bowel distension, clearly pneumatosis we've described, and also portovenous gas, in the presence of thrombi. So that must mean your patient is sick and he has concerning for full thickness ischemia, probably needs an operation. Maybe. Pneumatosis and portovenous gas in this particular review had an odds ratio of almost 2. The presence of mural thrombus also significant. Pneumatosis and portovenous gas exhibited good specificity, 83%, but low sensitivity, an indication that transmural bowel had actually resulted. So a CT scan, even though it is almost a pathologist diagnosis, it is not always indicative that the patient has full thickness necrosis and needs an operation. So what are the typical etiologies? Well, most of the time it is a mesenteric ischemia of one flavor over another. Occasionally infection, depending on, you know, what your primary etiology happens to be. Clearly obstructive with resulting increasing intraluminal pressure resulting in inadequate blood flow, whether it's venous or progressing to arterial, resulting in death of the local wall of the bowel. various other etiologies, drugs, inflammation, and other etiologies. And it is still a very significant poor outcome, especially in as it results from mesenteric ischemia. Portovenous gas is associated with significant poor outcome. And also, if you are a critique your CT scan, if you've lost some of the mural enhancement, that clearly is evident. And then there's always a white count. So if you have a patient without an elevated white count, without an elevated lactate, in CT scan findings and pneumatosis, without peritonitis, you really have to question whether or not this patient needs an operation. So this patient did go to the operation. Patient had these findings on open laparotomy. This patient had peritonitis. This patient had an elevated lactate. CT scan demonstrated pneumatosis intestinalis and portovenous gas. This patient needed an operation several hours ago. And with that, it was a short discussion.
Perfect. Perfect. Do I have questions from the audience? I have one. Have you seen this in patients on positive pressure ventilation without other abdominal findings? I've seen this, but how often have you seen this?
Quite often. We tend to use APRV in a lot of our sick patients with increasing intrathoracic pressures, and especially patients with evidence of COPD. It is not uncommon to have either clinically significant pneumothoraces, which end up resulting in pneumoperitoneum. Occasionally, you will actually also see some evidence of pneumatosis, usually along the transverse colon, but you just have to continue to monitor. And occasionally, if you're unsure, probably the safe thing to do is put a laparoscope.
Do we have any questions from the floor? Yes, I see one.
Did the patient survive?
This patient did not. No, and as mentioned, most of these patients have progressed to pretty extensive pneumatosis. One of the questions we actually ask in this type of setting is whether or not the patient actually deserves to go to the operating room and, as opposed to be managed expectantly.
Rear microphone.
Dr. Diaz, thank you. I want to ask, is there any role for further recess? Once you get to that pneumatosis with the lactated 2, is there any role for continued resuscitation, or that should that be an automatic operation?
Well, one of the dogmas of general surgery has always been to resuscitate your patient before going to the operating room. And I think if you're on the fence with a marginal lactate, maybe without peritonitis, maybe a slightly elevated white count, these are the typical post-cardiac surgery patients, there may be a short period of resuscitation to see whether or not they get better or not. But always, I think, if you have doubt, if you have concern, the safe thing to do is go to the operating room.
Thank you, Dr. Diaz. You. Our next speaker is Dr. Steve Hughes, professor of surgery at the University of Florida, Shands in Gainesville, Florida, who's going to talk to us about pancreatic necrosis.
Thank you, Dr. Sharp. Thanks, everybody, for sticking around till Thursday and for this final talk of the session. I have no disclosures. Pancreatic necrosis is a rather heterogeneous disease, not only in the anatomy, but the presence or absence of the extent of necrosis, and then ultimately the peripancreatic fluid collections that ensue and how they track down the national tissue planes, leading to this whether or not the tail is left disconnected, as in disconnected duct syndrome, whether there's subsequent infection, and there's some fairly dramatic images here. What I want to talk with you about today is driven largely when I was asked to talk about this, about patients that are referred into our tertiary referral center and actually consultations we see about care in our own institution, where we continue to fail to follow evidence-based best practices with respect to severe necrotizing pancreatitis. So just walk through a few things. First of all, remember that severe pancreatitis represents only about a quarter of patients that are affected. It follows two phases. The initial phase is truly a systemic inflammatory response. This is not due to infection. And the second phase is the onset of infection, which typically occurs in the third to sixth week. In that context, the notion of prophylactic antibiotics to prevent that second phase has been debased, and prophylactic antibiotics are no longer in vogue. Secondly, the use of total parenteral nutrition in these patients actually aggravates the incidence of infection and is to be avoided in almost all circumstances. Tube feeds, in fact, are in, and in our own institution, it is a very rare patient where we cannot maintain adequate nutrition with enteral feeding. The other thing that I've noted is that the step-up approach has become incredibly in. But the reality is that a number of patients receive drains when, in fact, drains are not indicated. Drains are placed for the patient who is decompensating in the third to sixth week, because that means they're infected. But in the first 2 weeks, please do not place drains. That is not a very typical scenario. Once you place a drain, you have committed the patient to a very different clinical course. If you do place a drain, even in the step-up approach, realize that the majority of those patients are ultimately going to undergo a surgical procedure. The other thing that we've noticed is that patients get placed on a shelf for a long period of time. And in reality, while maybe a little more controversial, I could argue that there's fairly compelling data that regardless of the etiology, in a patient who needs surgical management of peripancreatic necrosis or other fluid collections, you should take the gallbladder out. I just wanted to emphasize, here's an example of a patient who I got asked by the radiologist, should I put a drain in? This is 1 week after their onset of symptoms demonstrating extensive necrosis. Here's 2 weeks. Here's 3 weeks. Here's 4 weeks when I sent the patient home. Most importantly, for the patient perspective, it leaves them without any external drains, and in fact, you can even transition a patient who's been percutaneously drained to no external drains at the time of this operation. You also can perform cholecystectomy at the same time, and in patients who have had critical illness, place enteric feeding system. I like to use a transgastric combination GJ tube that allows drainage of the unemptying stomach along with distal tube feeds. It can be performed through a small upper incision, although it can also be done laparoscopically. Please understand, I'm very prone to the laparoscope, but I like the operation open because the finger is the best debriding tool I have found. We can do this through a very small anterior gastrotomy placed just proximal longitudinally to the pylorus. As I show here, the necrosectomy can be performed even and a percutaneously placed drain removed at the same time. And here's a picture of that transgastric. With a disconnected remnant. They have a variety of severity of their disease, with half of them actually having a benign course with respect to organ dysfunction and other illness. And we followed these folks for at least 2 years. And what I was impressed with is that the operation is rather durable. Fewer than 15% of these patients ultimately went on to require an additional operation. So the majority of them, I think, actually create a persistent fissure between the pancreatic body tail that's been disconnected and the stomach. The CT scan demonstrates 1 and 2 weeks after a transgastric necrosectomy showing a rapid resolution of the peripancreatic necroma. A couple of things to consider if you want to embark on this approach to necrosectomy. First of all, it is not for the faint of heart. Do recall that the splenic vein and splenic artery, as well as the celiac axis and portal vein, are at risk during this procedure. And if you get into them, you have got a wolf by both ears. I would encourage you to consider a referral for these patients, and it's beyond the concept of this talk, But I do think that complicated pancreatitis may become a disease of tertiary centers in the future. If you do this, the other thing I'll tell you is that I like to bring a 10-millimeter straight scope direct viewing onto the field so that you can actually explore the necrotic cavity at the completion of your debridement to ensure that you've done an adequate necrosectomy. And then finally, if you're going to do this, I strongly encourage you to make sure that your interventional radiologist and advanced endoscopist are on board with you, either for that postoperative pseudoaneurysm bleeding, or on occasion you may need an endoscopic reintervention for the patient who has recurrent sepsis after your operation. And then finally, I'll leave with this. It's always great. I want to thank my good friends and colleagues who just published this prior. It's online available in the September issue of Annals of Surgery. It's a large series that I think provides strong evidence this transgastric necrosectomy is a popular thing. We still don't know the anatomic considerations. I do think that this operation can be performed for patients that have some retrocolic extension or extension into the root of the mesentery or even over into the pancreatic head and down the right paracolic gutter. But certainly as these collections extend down towards the pelvis, the notion that this is going to be adequate in and of itself requires further investigation. And I'll close my comments on that. I want to thank for the invitation. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Do we have questions from the audience? So, Steve, did somebody get up? Okay. Steve, have you, in using the VARD approach, have you asked your radiologist to put in drains that you then upsize, but you try to put them in from a more creative approach, say, you know, from the flank?
What a wonderful question. Yes, that is exactly what we do. In fact, we ask them, don't place one, but place two. And we want them one hand's breadth apart, kind of the way you teach, you know, your people learning laparoscopy. And we typically ask them not to go through the ribs. So, yes. And VARDS is something that's popular at our institution as an alternative to this transgastric necrosectomy. But obviously remember that the step-up approach, actually three-fourths of the patients were excluded because their anatomy was not friendly to a VARDS approach. Yes, sir.
Hi. Could you elaborate what you do with the posterior wall of the stomach after you've done your debridement? Do you just leave it open? Is it something that you
Sure. That's
repair?
A great question. In fact, this article demonstrates that this is a safe procedure even in the setting of splenic vein thrombosis and gastric varices. What I do is I make probably about a 4 or 5 centimeter posterior gastrotomy into the necroma. I have ultrasound on the field in case you need it, but typically finding that necroma is like falling out of a canoe and finding water. What I do is then actually do a locking, running PDS suture all the way around that kind of provides a hemostatic suture and leaves a large communication between the cavity and the stomach. When I place the feeding tube, I actually keep the patient NPO and we just make them tube feed dependent and leave the G-tube to gravity for 2 weeks. They're typically home within 7 days. Then 2 weeks afterwards, I allow them to start on liquids, but I don't let them take pills. And at a month, we let them eat whatever they want and we pull the tube out and they get on with their lives.
So, thank you, Dr. Hughes. I'd like to thank all of our speakers for a very stimulating set of presentations.